Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraic Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and featuring an interview I recorded a few weeks ago with the writer and Hackney resident Ian Sinclair. Ian Sinclair is a British writer, documentarist, filmmaker, poet, flaneur, psychogeographer, metropolitan prophet and urban shaman, a keeper of lost cultures and a futurologist. His books include Downriver, Whitechapel, Scarlet Tracings, Lights Out for the Territory, Dining on Stones, London Orbital, and most recently, Hackney, That Rose Red Empire. He's also the editor of London, City of Disappearances. So, Ian, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today. I was going to start off by asking you why Hackney, but I just walked from London Field Station through the park, through the back streets in the spring sunshine, so it sort of made that question redundant, to be honest. But so let's talk about how did you end up in Hackney in the first place?
Yeah, well, I came to Hackney, you know, for a few days, because this is way back in 1968. Some friends of mine I'd known from Dublin, where I'd been a student, had got a house, and it was the notion was to have a communal house and to bring all kinds of people together, and would we like to come and stay for a bit? And we stayed, and I liked it. You know, it was a very cheap, modest area. It was totally unpretentious. There were street markets. It was good for walking, which I liked. You could open up onto the canal system and get out into what's the Lee Valley and down to the Thames, and it was just pleasant. So I stayed and stayed, and then coincidentally, it turned out that they started to demolish a lot of these terraced houses. The idea was to put up tower blocks, and so the condemned houses were very, very cheap, and I just had a little bit of money in from having done a documentary film about Allen Ginsberg at the Roundhouse. And so, mad as it seemed at the time, because nobody ever bought a house, I bought one of these condemned properties for just a couple of £1,000, and in the expectation it would be gone in a year or 2 years, and we get our money back and we, you know, move on or go back to renting in the usual way. But it didn't happen. Things turned around. Ronan Point disaster happened. Tower blocks were not seen to be such a good thing. It's not that they were not a bad thing, but they were so poorly built in a lot of cases. And this is a conservation area by the blink of an eyeball, and so having somewhere to live gave me a base and for all of the odd things I wanted to do, and I've stayed ever since.
I was going to say, you know, the idea that this house and, you know, 50 yards up there, Albion Square, not being here and just being a block is unthinkable now, walking around it today.
Yeah, well, there's it's a symbol at that time there of one way of you looking at a development and the idea that you had to find housing, and a lot of the houses at that time were just derelict. They were empty, and a lot of council-owned properties were just not being used. I remember going round the height of that squatting movement and repossession movement, sticking up notices over houses, because just so many here were empty. Nobody wanted to be in them, or the council were not doing anything and leaving them in a completely decayed state in the hope they'd fall down and put something else in their place. So it was a strange moment, and now at the moment is another kind of parallel thing, where the whole area is, in many ways, is being obliterated or changed so rapidly. The walk I've just done today, I've been through the borough and along the Regent's Canal and up to past the Olympic site, up to Springfield Park, and tranches and tranches have just disappeared off the map. I mean, I met a guy jogging on the edge of Hackney Wick there, and he'd been doing it around this area for 21 years, and he said it really was his life's blood, and he felt more than ever in the past division between rich and poor and between the sort of global developments and the lack of interest in the people that just wanted to use this landscape. So he felt expelled from his own landscape, and the whole canal bank all the way down to the stadium itself was covered with waterfalls. Water was just gushing out, and the whole thing was closed, and I thought this was some grotesque water feature, but it just turned out it was a kind of disastrous spillage from the Olympic site. So this toxic water was just pouring wow. into the River Lee. It's an amazing image.
And that's going on there now, right now?
This is today, this morning, a couple of hours ago, yes. So it's hot news.
Well, I wanted to sort of get on to this idea, obviously the Olympics a bit later, but we're there now, so we may as well go straight into it. There's the Olympic site, which obviously is a huge expanse of land. We've often had the filmmaker Jonathan Meads on the show, and he talks about something called the regeneration racket, and that's obviously going on here in Hackney as well. As you said, there's these blocks of, well, to call them flats would probably not be the right word, sort of loft apartments that are going up, which I suppose before there was a massive global meltdown, people were expecting to be filled once the Olympics got into full swing. I mean, is that still going to happen, do you think?
No, it's not going to happen. Because we've had a rehearsal, we've had several rehearsals, endless rehearsals for this. We had the whole Millennium Dome fiasco, which was just putting up this tent and then using that as a scam to create this big development behind it, which never really took, because you're on a toxic peninsula.
The Greenwich Peninsula is covered in those sort of empty flats. Yeah.
Most of which empty. And the getting of the World Games before this, which was supposed to happen at Pickett's Lock, and there's an enormous development around there. But there's been so many problems with the waste from the Enfield waste burning facility right next to Pickett's Lock there were people coming out in blotches and splots and cancers and poison. And, the whole thing is just so horrible it doesn't even bear thinking about. And they say they just sort of forgot about Pickett's Lock and never took it on. And the major fiasco has been cooking and cooking and cooking for so long, and this is it. And it's like a kind of invasion philosophy. You're in this sense of mind where you walk into Iraq, or you kind of blitz into Afghanistan, and why not do it on your own doorstep in a kind of commercial sense, that you just obliterate this landscape. And now there's these huge perimeter fences. They do look like a kind of concentration camp enclosing an enormous supermarket. It's got kind of slabs of supermarket with compulsory Olympic trash around it.
And of course, one of the buzzwords for the Olympic site is the legacy, which I suppose you could look at in both ways, couldn't you?
An Australian supermarket and a monumental debt pit that nobody's ever going to crawl out of. So I just come back from Athens, and this is a J.G. Ballard theme park. These are these enormous pieces of vanity architecture, totally empty, in wilderness parklands, no use to anybody. And the only things that have been used are ones that have been taken over by football clubs, which is a really hard sell in the case of the Olympics here, because it's not suitable. It's going to cost sort of $120 million to convert it into something that can be used for a football club.
People will often point you in the direction of Barcelona at this point and say, yeah, but look at Barcelona. Barcelona's managed to do something with its Olympic legacy, but of course Barcelona's also somewhere people might want to go and visit, I suppose.
Barcelona is a kind of special case, because it had been so denied and choked under Franco. It was a kind of Republican city, so it was ripe for some form of development, and this came along at the right time. But even there, so I'm told, there are parts that were money was shoved into for the Olympics, which are still pretty much deserted and abandoned and not useful. So a development was useful, and it happened. It happened quite well there. Los Angeles, to some extent, worked because they didn't build anything. They just adapted what was already part of the structure. And if you do it that way, there's no reason you can't do it. But when you put yourself in hoc for monumental projects, just as a kind of sense of vanity, and endlessly rabbit on about a legacy, when the legacy is literally destroying everything that's there presently, it's insane. It's insane, completely insane.
While we're still on this same subject, I'm going to skip to one of your previous novels, Dining on Stones, which is about a journey up the A13. And up there there's this whole area that they now designate as the Thames Gateway, the floodplains, which they're going to build monumental housing projects on as well.
So. Yeah, well, they've all been sort of abandoned, because all the whole of Thames Gateway was the old regime. So when Boris came in, he didn't like the idea of Thames Gateway. There was supposed to be a bridge going across Beckton, which would have made the transport. He cancelled all this stuff straight away, and he wants his own huge vanity project. He wants
his airport.
Gigantic Eagle Comic Airport, the Boris Johnson Airport, you know, in the middle of the estuary, destroying everything there. These guys are going crazy. These are literally kind of Mussolini-level crazy, all of them, and they want grander and more and more insane projects, immediately cancelling the ones that have been associated with their hated predecessor. It's a kind of nightmare. And we've realised that we're actually voting in this group of utterly mad people, and we can't see any way out of it. I mean, in Hackney, behind this area where everything has collapsed, there was a central library on Mare Street, a really superb library, which completely kind of closed down and brought over into another thing, and poured money into it to turn it into a music venue called Ocean, which died, along with all the other stuff there. Even the Hackney Empire Theatre had to be closed down. And behind it is this gigantic sort of Stansted Airport-style development, which is the council's own property, which gets bigger and bigger and bigger, while everything fades away and dies in front of it. And just a little further up, Tesco's are now becoming the major developer. So essentially, the whole of Hackney becomes a suburb of Tesco's. Tesco's is the essence, and you just put up housing to filter the people into your supermarket. Endgame. I think we really are in a kind of architectural, social, cultural endgame here. So it's a good place to write about. Go back to your original question.
Yeah, and the book, Hackney, That Rosewood Empire, is what we're talking about at the moment. And it's many things, but one of them is a sort of, you know, a love story about Hackney. But it's not gone down that well with the council, has it? I mean, you're obviously quite critical of the council in the book.
But. Yes, I am. I am critical of the council in the book. But the banning of me from doing a reading in a local library in Stoke Newington was nothing to do with the book, because it happened before the book appeared. Uh-huh. And it was a bizarre story that I was banned from this small library event as a way of generating monumental publicity. It just completely backfired. And then local activists used the Freedom of Information Act and discovered that the only reason for this ban was that I'd written a piece in the London Review of Books which was critical of the Olympics. And the mayor, Jules Pipe, had stated, you know, no, this person must not be allowed into any council property because he's against the Olympics. But they denied that point blank. You know, they tried to manage the news in that classic spinning style. So you can't have controversial subjects discussed in a library. You know, you can't talk about Afghanistan in a library. So what else? You know, this is what the tradition, especially up in Stoke Newington, with Daniel Defoe and all the rest of it, is that you actually do discuss things in libraries. This is where else are you going to go?
Where else are you going to go?
So anyway, this was a supreme own goal for me, because I was sort of on the Today programme in 5 minutes, because the two things that people care about are libraries and allotments, and they've managed to fuck up with both of them.
Let's, I want to look a little bit about taking, you know, all of your work as a whole, your working method and your writing style, and I've seen your working method described in various places as basically walking and writing. So what do they mean by that?
What I think what happens was there was a certain period around the time I did a book called Lights Out for the Territory when there began to be a lot of material written about the idea of walking in cities and the French notion of psychogeography, situationism, and these kind of things. And this book arrived at a point where I was starting to do specific conceptual journeys, walking shapes into London as a way of investigating things and treating documentation as a way of opening up a new kind of fiction. Therefore, the whole walking thing started to emerge as a topic. It was totally accidental to me before that. I mean, in all the stuff I'd written previously, there was an element of walking, but it wasn't the method. The methodology of walking, writing, observing evolved, I suppose, from around about the mid-90s.
You've mentioned there the idea of psychogeography, which is, you know, you're one of a number of people right at the minute who are labelled with that. And it's I think it was Guy Debord who actually coined the term, and it sort of comes out of the situationist movement. So apart from it being a working method that you've been able to adopt, how did this did the situationist movement influence you in any way?
No, it didn't really. I mean, I kind of don't read or have any truck with philosophy of any sort, or theoretics. You know, I'm not a theoretician. I did flick through the stuff. I was aware of it well in, when it happened in the 60s, but I mean, it wasn't very meaningful to me or important. And I picked up on it second time round or third time round by way of people like Stuart Home, who were here living in the area generally and putting out the London Psychogeographical Association newsletter, which was an interestingly provocative document that played games with those notions and also adapted ley lines and other kind of spirit paths and things that I'd always been interested in writing about in terms of London as a way of just tapping and mapping the energies of place.
This is an aspect of it that I'm particularly interested in as the producer and presenter of what we build as a rationalist radio show.
This is all wonderfully irrational.
Indeed. And we interviewed Alan Moore a few weeks ago, and we spoke about Glycon, his god. And, you know, he was very forthright in that, you know, he knew this was an irrational, ludicrous thing, but somehow it just made his life more interesting to be interested in that. And
well, if you've got to live in Northampton, you must have a few things to keep life interesting.
This is very true, but then perhaps we could also apply the same thing to Hackney. And I wonder if, you know, is...
I wonder who the god of Hackney is.
Indeed.
I haven't tapped him yet.
Are these sort of ideas sort of useful and perhaps even necessary to sort of survive in the sort of extreme urban environment?
They are useful and necessary as a device against the kind of overwhelming imbecility of the corporate imagination, mm-hmm. or de-imagination, when everything is boastful. You know, you pass a kind of most crass development you've ever seen in your life being thrown together, and there's a notice on it that says improving the image of construction. They don't give a monkey's about what they're building. They're actually constructing these virtual images. So you're in a world of absolute virtual imagery, computer-generated imagery. It's a sort of graphic novel, essentially, the graphic novel of mm-hmm. development and legacy and heritage creation. How do you oppose that? Well, I think you kind of, if you can summon up some toad god with a diamond in his head, that kind of irrational, insane way is a pretty good method of dealing with this and pointing out the absurdity of the materialism.
I've read famously this is the method you apply to dealing with Thatcher, basically.
Yes, that was. I always felt that she was a sort of witch-like figure who was drawing in all the bad will of the country at that time, which was pretty serious and substantial. And she energized herself by it from being a kind of a peeved housewife at the start. She became this sort of bourdieu of the right, with her armies and her invasions and her blowing people out of the ground and stomping on the miners. And I felt it was a kind of almost an occult state. So I said that you create this novel downriver as a kind of series of ritual movements around her developments as a method of getting rid of her. And if she wasn't gone 12 months after the finish of the book, then the whole thing was a complete failure. And she was. So this worked. You know, I was really responsible for getting rid of Mrs. Thatcher.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Ian Sinclair. Ian, so you've just revealed that you were responsible for the downfall of Margaret Thatcher. One of the characters that appears in Hackney, that Roosevelt Empire, is one Anthony Blair, who, interestingly, I'm not sure if this is just time sort of rubbing the edges off Thatcher, but a surprising amount of people, I find, leftists, describe Tony Blair as being worse than Thatcher.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen you do it yourself. Mm,
I think that is the final decision. It's been uncanny. The longer he's gone on, the sort of more burnished becomes her image, the nostalgia around her. If she was anywhere near reality, you know, I don't think that would be the case. But he has turned out to be phenomenally, interestingly awful. And that was not evident, because he comes in on such a wave of support and relief, really, to be rid of this poisonous regime, this toxic entity that had hung on for so long. And, you know, I remember vividly being in a pub in Brick Lane, which is now gone, that night, with an amazingly mixed demographic in the back room at the pool table. There was a Sikh barman, there were kind of local people who'd been in the brewery, all kinds of, and they're all watching the screen, and there's a sense of cheering and celebration that they've gone and this new thing is going to start. So they start on a kind of wave of goodwill, and then within minutes are just picking up on the old clapped out Tory notions, and they're doing the Millennium Dome and all that, and I thought, oh my God, you know, and as we went on, it got worse and worse and worse, and now he's suffering from these messianic delusions, and the whole lot of them are just swine at the trough in a most appalling way. It's been revealed that actually they are worse because their kind of presentation levels were better, their manipulations were more successful.
And they, you know, they did a few nice things, Sure Start and what have you, the minimum wage and all that.
Yeah, I mean, they did a few things, but then the net overall end product is totally catastrophic.
Is it inevitable then, do you think? I mean,
it is. I mean, anyone who basically wants to be elected should be immediately disqualified for that. There's no such thing as a good politician.
So perhaps we should do leadership on a sort of jury service type where people should be picked at random.
I think you should, yes, absolutely. Either you go through, there's a sort of real zen sternness of training for a kind of a group of people who would serve and were barely remunerated for it, a sort of monk-like cadre of people who did it because they believed in it, and the rest jury serviced in, you all have to do your time.
Let's just go back to something we didn't touch on earlier about Hackney, and bringing again sort of, you know, the idea, this psychogeographical idea of, I suppose, historical layers of residents leaving something behind. And Hackney is a place that's possibly most famous to people who have never been to Hackney in their lives, as a place that's, you know, consistent waves of immigration come to. So do you think, is that something that gives it something?
Yeah, I think that's a special quality, really, was that it was a staging post, specifically at one point for a lot of people coming out of the Whitechapel, Jewish, and settling around areas like Victoria Park and Stamford Hill, and really bringing a kind of very rich and argumentative culture with them, and then probably moving on. So Hackney was a refuge, and that goes back all the way, you know, even back to Samuel Pepys being sent out from around Fleet Street, where he was growing up as a child, to a farm in Hackney to get better air and healthy food and drink milk and stuff. And it was a garden area. It was really a special kind of suburb, because it just has that nice relation to the city, the original settlement. And outside the walls, you go through a zone that's dangerous, that has the theatres and brothels and all kinds of permissions and archery fields. And then you're coming out into the country. You're on the Great North Road. Here we are in Albion Drive. This is the first house built on this site, which is amazing. 1840s, this is, you know, the first house that appears. A speculative developer gets the right to bring the terraces down from London Fields. But before that, this is just farmland, and this is sort of market garden land that's supplying the city. So you've got rich soil, and you do have a kind of pastoral sense to it that I suppose fades away completely when the old Hackney Brook was enclosed, which was a river that went from the Lea right up to the slopes of Highgate. So the magical traces are there very, very evidently, and equally it's been a place with a leftist sort of tradition, an argumentative tradition of communities building up that were there because it was slightly outside the mainstream, slightly off to the side, and great things were done. And again, it's coming back to life in some ways at the moment. I mean, hard to say how it'll go, but in zones around Broadway Market, for example, there's just thousands of young people are coming in there, and I know it's all cafes and Portobello Road, but nevertheless there is a sense of cultural renewal, and there's a lot of people want to live here and think it's a kind of hip place to be, which is going to be interesting to see how that evolves.
But then in the face of that sort of new development and the sort of, you know, the corporate face of that is obviously there's a tension there between, you know, that face doesn't have any, it doesn't care about the, you know, the preservation of those sort of layers of history.
That's again a kind of motive for the book, was some sense of avoiding this amnesia about that it doesn't matter really what the history was, or, I mean, unless you can manipulate it in some way and lay claim to it to improve your own image. I really think the loss of that theatre up on Dalston, which had been a Victorian circus and you know, then a state-of-the-art cinema in the 1920s, Black Club, Four Aces, and then finally Labyrinth. All of these different generations of people had got use out of this building, and people were proposing all sorts of ways of, using it again and doing things with it. And of course, it had no chance because it had to be obliterated to put up the Barrett homes that would give the financing to do the transport hub, which was just a great slab of concrete, which was only there so justified by the presence of the Olympics. So you've got a mega kind of destructive development, I think, and an obliteration of a whole story, a whole chunk of history just goes. And what was a very interesting road for a long time, very nicely caught by Patrick Wright in his mm-hmm. book Journey Through Ruins, just the sort of last days of it when it was pretty trashed, but it was still packed with a kind of life.
So what are these new incomers that you're talking about, the people that are sort of enlivening areas like Broadway Market?
I don't know. It's just the funny thing was, when Hackney book came out, I don't think anybody came to interview me, I mean, whatever they were working for, who didn't actually now live in Hackney. Mm-hmm. So there was a sort of huge sense of a media presence, mostly up towards Stoke Newington, I guess, but still. So those kind of people were here. And then younger people have heard that it's a kind of interesting, trendy, it's near Hoxton, near Shoreditch, all of that. They're coming here. So I don't know, you know, and I don't know. Around Hackney Wick, there are people squatting in the warehouses that are just about to disappear. And there's a lot of art projects going on that are related in some way to opposing the Olympics or doing painting on walls or doing all that stuff.
I wonder if they do actually find what they're looking for when they get here, though, because, you know, in some respects,
if they're like me, they don't. But that's the whole point, because, I mean, you're kind of motivated to carry on looking. I'm beginning to realise I'm not going to succeed. It's taken 50 years, but there you are.
There's a fantastic description of Hackney. You describe it as like a chart-topping borough. And that, you know, it has the worst deprivation and the best crime figures and things in the country. So,
yeah, it has been at the top of all those kind of charts for a long time.
So this is, of course, what these people find as well. You know, people that are coming for the nice cafes and the lattes and whatever will also find this.
Yeah, there are zones which are still edgy, and there is sort of arbitrary crime, but that's not kind of. Really, I mean, I've lived here long enough and it doesn't affect you. I mean, it's not sort of threatening just to be moving through any particular place. Although people have been killed right here on the doorstep. So it's there, but it's sort of semi-visible or invisible. And the general atmosphere, somehow, the atmosphere of what was here originally is still part of what this area is. There is this kind of special breathing space that's still available, though is beginning to shrink and close down because the permissions to move in certain ways are being denied. You can't just walk where you want to, you can't just wander. Every time you step out, another road has disappeared, another whole area is closed off. Things are vanishing very, very fast. But at the moment, I think it's still possible.
Let's widen ourselves out from Hackney and take in the whole of England, basically. Mm-hmm. You've just embarked on collaborating on a project called An English Journey Reimagined, which is sort of redoing some of the things that J.B. Priestley wrote about back in the 1930s, I presume.
Yeah, well, this has really just been two events, one in Alborough and one in Gateshead, both with Alan Moore. And the person behind that was a guy called Paul Smith, who I've worked with a lot in the past, because he always believed that it was interesting to... He was a music producer, essentially, but he really liked that tradition of putting on multicultural events, happenings in strange places. So we were always in slaughterhouses in Smithfield or the old Bridewell Theatre. I mean, somewhere strange. And mixing together musicians, filmmakers, writers, sometimes performing, sometimes in conversation, sometimes... collaborating directly with the musician, and I think he wanted to do it, but to do it the way we did was now economically so much more difficult. It needs a level of sponsorship and pitch. Mm-hmm. So he talked to various people, and I think he wanted a thing to hang it on, and he was reading Priestley's Journey, and he thought, well, that's what I'll do. I don't think it meant very much to either Alan Moore or me, but we liked the idea of a sort of travelling circus show and picking up local elements as you did it. And I thought the one in Gateshead that we just did worked really well because the local poet Tom Pickard, who had not said he'd not read in Newcastle or Gateshead, where he come from, for quite a long time. So his return was sort of special. And there was film footage of him as a young guy sitting with the old poet Basil Bunting, who was the godfather of the poets up there. So it was actually a returning poetic mixed with some pretty amazing, destructive, loud music and stones being smashed up and collaged film and all the rest of it. And it really was kind of special. And then Alan got up and declaimed his sort of seance on the area, and people who would maybe only have read graphic novels or seen the kind of abortive films from his work realised that he's a different kind of writer and presence. So I thought the whole thing was worth doing. But I mean, it would be nice if it kind of kept on the road and moved on for some time.
But would it in any way influence you to sort of take your methodology to other areas of the country?
Oh, well, I have done. Before this came up, you know, the book I'm working on at the moment is all about other areas of the country, because it's sort of looking at that age of the grand project, the philosophy of throwing up these things and reckoning you can kind of patronise a depressed culture by erecting something that nobody needs, like a rock and roll museum or a strange eco park in
Port Moon. Or a garden festival.
Any of those, all of this stuff, cities of culture, the whole nonsense of that is, I've been travelling and rambling around Britain over the last few years, looking into that and using walking or using my Hackney Freedom Pass to ride free on buses from Liverpool to Hull, for example, 12 buses, to sort of road test this notion of a superhighway that Will Allsop, the architect, came up with a super city which folded
right across
the
country
too, and meant that the whole area is equivalent in some way. If you live in Yorkshire, it doesn't just the same as if you lived in Lancashire. It's all part and parcel of this thing, which seems to now be the philosophy they're doing the election on. I think they've invented the notion of motorway man as being the key electoral figure. And Newsnight sort of rang up the other day and said, we're in this service station off the motorway and we're going to do the electoral broadcast from there. You know,
where is J.G. Ballard?
Weird. So that's actually what I have been doing a lot of for the last 2-3 years. And finally, you know, I've been in Berlin and Athens and Dublin and all of these cities that are in some way troubled by their kind of grand project or Olympic pasts.
I mentioned Jonathan Meads earlier in the programme, and again, this is another one of his themes, this idea of, you know, the big destination museum thrown up in a city. So you clearly, already said you think this is
a
patronising and appalling idea.
I thought so. I mean, they divided it. I was talking to Will also about, they divided up the north of England like kind of Gauleiters. They said, well, you know, he said, I would like Scunthorpe, and he got given Barnsley, or, you know, whatever it is. They all patched it up, and then they got these places and they threw some coloured lights around them and thought this actually would improve the quality of life in some major way. And I think one of Jonathan Meads' theses is this idea of the similarity between New Labour and the Third Reich, that he believed that the kind of understanding of the manipulation of news media was what Goebbels brought to the 1936 Olympic Games, and we've just copied it. And he said that the similarity is that they're both new parties. They were newly invented parties. And the German one was not being run by people who were actually German. They were all Austrians or incomers. And the New Labour is essentially a kind of Scottish machine for destroying England. It's their final revenge, and it's, you know, it's worked supremely, but nobody's noticed. And the whole Olympic kind of quango world is entirely run by Irishmen, like Heathrow Airport. And it's the kind of revenge of the Irish Republicans for all of the British colonial disasters. Like, you know, this is what's happening, and it's not even been noticed.
And to finish off, I'm fascinated by the world of the book dealers, and you've obviously, you know, a lot of you used to be a book dealer yourself, and a lot of the characters in your writing are book dealers. I'd be interested to know what you think the future is of this industry, because, you know, we're at a point now where people are, decrying the future of the book.
You
because
mean
of
the new book or the second-hand book? I survived after this early Hackney hippie-ish period of labouring as a book dealer, and I was book dealer from 1975 through for 15 odd years. And it was a wonderful, really wonderful way of life and a wonderful period, because at that time there were still lots and lots of bookshops all over. Every small town had bookshops. There were books pouring out onto the street markets of London. And apart from anything else, apart from making a living, it was an education for me, because I came across a lot of obscure writers, London writers, that people would enthuse about. Gerald Kirsch and James Curtis and Alexander Baron and all these kind of people that I wouldn't have come across, you know, just normally, because they were not part of the educational curriculum. Mm-hmm. So they emerge from fans who come up to my bookstore. I had a stall in Camden Passage every week, so I'm standing there, you know, for 3 days, get to hear a lot of stuff and to meet a lot of people, and that was invaluable. Well, now, I mean, I'm not searching for books in that same sense, but when I go into the small country towns or on the coast, the shops are kind of vanishing or deeply depressed, because the internet has taken it all over. People sell on eBay, and also there's a sense that you could check the price of anything, whereas in the old days prices were random. It was like time.
Mm-hmm.
Before the railways got going, every different part of Britain had a slightly different sense of time. You just relied on the village clock, and there were differences. So suddenly the book world is unified, and equally the new book publishers, which I have dealings with now, are really panicky about things like literary fiction. So if I wanted to write the kind of books I started with, Downriver or Raid on Dort or something, nobody would publish them. They really would be just, you know, some sort of vanity project. I have to publish it myself, which is deeply depressing.
Just to jump in there, one of the things I've forgotten to mention is I'm sort of amused by how this book, Hackney, is categorised as travel stroke fiction.
The Hackney book, as far as I'm concerned, is fiction. It's a kind of, I keep saying it's fiction, it's a documentary fiction. I've used all the techniques of fiction in writing it. And I've played with documented reality in various ways. Some of the characters who give interviews are in part or totally invented. Sometimes there's an interview where a real character has told me stuff, but they don't want it under their name, so I've invented another character. I mean, I've done all those kind of things that would be part of fiction, and it's even the new book I'm doing now, which is more ostensibly documentary in its discussion of these things, also uses a lot of those same techniques and blurs and several occasions into one. And if the story is better suited to something happening here than there, I'll change it and change the dates and change the times and everything.
Let's just go back to the book dealers again.
Yeah. To go back to the beginning of the book dealing, the really interesting thing for me was the particular kinds of characters who had come in. I mean, ones who were long established and in that world and were eccentric in their own way, and then the people of my own age who were all coming into this as having failed in something else, or as sort of accidentally. And there were sort of old rock musicians or people who had been some form of hippie. There were a lot of those, and then there were strange visionary obsessives of every kind, and this book world seemed to offer them a ghetto in which they could operate, because you didn't need anything. All you went out and you looked for stuff, and if you found it, you survived. If you weren't good enough to find something that somebody wanted, then you didn't survive. It was great. It was a kind of completely freelance way of life, and a way of life that involved lots of travel and discussion and chatting. So I couldn't have really moved in from where I started as a poet to being a storyteller and a fiction writer without that experience of the book world, and I think it's a real loss.
Well, you say it's a loss. I mean, I was going to ask, does it survive anyway? I mean, there's like,
well, it survives, but not anything like the same form. Obviously,
there's almost like the sort of, I don't know, I suppose to describe it as a sort of heritage industry type way of doing it, like under the Waterloo Bridge or sort of Hay on Wye type.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to those bookstalls outside the National Film Theatre, say, there are all these, but they're incredibly boring. They're all look like remainders from Faber and Faber. They're just pages, tables and tables of sort of respectable paperbacks. There's nothing odd or weird or eccentric. Whereas if you'd gone down to Brick Lane or wandered up Kingsland Waste in the period I'm talking about, you know, you wouldn't know what you could find. Anything and everything would be there. Complete rubbish to big folios of Turner engravings, which I found, and things like that. You know, extraordinary things would be just here on the floor, and the excitement of doing that, and actually being able to make an interpretation of a form of culture. Because every week you put out this store, I'm curating an art show. I'm actually choosing. I've only got this many books to put out, so I'm choosing, I'm selecting, and I'm making kind of cultural judgments, which was a very interesting thing to do as a form. I would say the catalogues I used to do as a book dealer were actually a form of fiction, because you're picking some obscure writer that nobody's really heard of, and you write them up. You know, make it sound really interesting. Make a pitch for somebody that's forgotten, and therefore you're actually inventing a kind of character. Although there are actual books, and I think that form of listing is an interesting form of fiction that J.G. Ballard, say, was a master of. Mm-hmm. He would do, you know, short stories that were lists or terse answers, and that's it. And Bellano's book about Nazi writers in the Americas is another form of kind of ostensibly series of potted biographies that become a fiction. So all of these things are actually perfect fictional training.
So that world's gone.
It's not gone, but it's kind of very bruised and battered. There's not much of it left in the sense that I knew it.
There still exists a trade in second-hand books, but mainly via Abe books and the like, so yes. Internet-type sites.
I think that's changed the world entirely. Mm. Not just book dealing, writing, new book dealing, the whole thing. I mean, I've many students have chatted to me over the years about what I do, without having read a single book, and yet having been able to carry on quite a good conversation by just downloading bits and pieces. They've read interviews on the net, seen clips of films. So they've kind of assembled a collage of stuff that's probably just as accurate, but they haven't actually learned how you navigate a book. They wouldn't dream of reading a book, 400 or 500-page book. I mean, it'd be just horribly hard work. They can't do it. So it happens in other ways, which is why it's interesting and worthwhile to have these conversations, because that is also a form of writing.
Well, I was going to come on to that, in that perhaps even in the future, if the worst forecast come to pass and everybody has electronic books, then the second-hand book industry will gradually disappear. But we're
calling rarefied objects collectors will have a sentimental attachment to these, the look and feel of these things, even if they don't read them. Mm-hmm. They'll have a certain amount about them. Will be a kind of, in a minimalist room, you might have a little shelf display of these beautiful objects.
Well, that's sort of what I was going to get to, because, like I said, we're doing a podcast now, and you're a multimedia artist. You've been a filmmaker, and perhaps that is where we're going to get to. Well, the books themselves become ornaments.
That's interesting, because you mentioned Jonathan Mead several times, and you presented him as a filmmaker. Well, when I first heard of Jonathan Mead, he was a journalist. He was writing, in always interesting copy, informed and argumentative and erudite stuff for various journals. So then he's a short story writer. He wrote very strange and weird short stories. Then large novels appear. And then the kind of polemic that he delivers as a journalist is presented in terms of a film, although he is not actually making the film. It's entirely his construct, and he has to do it like a parody of an ordinary documentary, because it has to be presenter-led, and he performs and delivers, because he was also an actor. So he is a complete construct, but the thing that seems to have hit with you is that he's a filmmaker, because he does these things. But they're only versions of what... I mean, it could be written texts quite easily.
I had this conversation with him a couple of weeks ago, but he can't get anything published at the moment.
No.
He can't get any writing published. So.
Well, I mean, this is insane. this is insane, because he was kind of a substantial writer. And I can remember when I went to Paladin, when I very started off, there was an editor there called Nick Austin. And his passion was certainly then for Jonathan Meads as a writer. And he was very encouraging to me. And he thought, this is interesting. This is, the kind of writing I want to have in two different forms. And both forms, I think, now are pretty much redundant and gone. And he has to has to, but he successfully can turned himself into a TV show, which is tolerated because it's too intelligent. So obviously, you know, it is.
It's ghettoized as well, isn't it? BBC Four ghetto. Ian, thanks very much for speaking to me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much. I'm glad I actually remembered at the last minute that you were coming.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.